Welcome to Swiss Impact with Banerjee. I'm Svetlana.
And I'm Ben.
In season 2, we will be traveling around the globe, out of Switzerland, and bring amazing leaders from businesses, thought leaders, political leaders, of course, investors and experts.
We're working at implementing and realizing all the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, better known as SDGs.
And they are also making profit.
Hello, I am Amina Gurifakim, and I'm the sixth president of the Republic of Mauritius.
My name is Parvati, and I'm a musical artist and the founder and CEO of Parvati Foundation.
I'm Amisha Adishmukhai. I'm an entrepreneur here in Bishmukhai. I'm running on one side of a financial services company.
You know, hundreds of deals a month, we are seeing more things happening in this impact world. And this is because, look, the world is changing.
So join us to discover impact investing ecosystem.
See you every Friday afternoon at 3 p.m. Central European time at Swiss Impact with Benedict.
See you on Friday. Act with impact.
Good morning, afternoon, and evening to everyone. And for our viewers from Far East, good night.
Welcome to Swiss Impact with Banerjee. And today it's already week 12 of season 2, where we interview global leaders, investors, inspiring projects, and of course, politicians sometimes.
Exactly, political leaders.
Exactly. And with our TV shows, for those who are new, we want to inspire to take an action. It's action-oriented, so everyone who is invited here will be challenged, and of course, the audience need to be inspired to take an action as well. Ben, do you have any story for today?
First, before I start, I want to speak about the charity or program we started in the name of my sister. It's doing quite very well. Thank you for all those who are supporting. So we are helping people all over India, especially in the rural areas and in the villages against COVID. So any help anybody can give is most welcome. The details you can find on the website camomile.ch. That is CAMOMILE.ch. So
thanks a lot for everyone who already donated, and it's really appreciated by all who receive the help. So thanks a lot for that.
And now you wanted to know the story. So
now the story, yes, please.
So today, as you know, many times in the past, I have spoken about the negative impact of climate on the climate because of eating meat. Well, apparently, the European Bureau of Statistics of the European Union came out with a report, I think, this week. They summarized, and they recommend that EU is doing too little to limit the consumption of the meat of its citizen if it wants to keep the Paris Agreement. Mm-hmm. So EU has invested, in fact, more than 100 billion euros in the agriculture policy between 2014 and 2020. Half of this expenditure is on the carbon change, but it seems nothing has happened. The greenhouse gas emission has not gone down. It has, in fact, gone up. So I would ask the taxpayers as a taxpayer, I would ask the question, where did that 100 billion disappear, and which lobby group influenced the disbursement of this fund?
Well, I've heard also that, in fact, the European policies have had the opposite effect. You know, for example, while it is known that cattle farming is responsible for nearly 50% of greenhouse gas emissions from agriculture, there are no policies in place to reduce that. And in fact, European money has been used to advertise and promote consumption of meat and dairy products. So its consumption doesn't reduce at all.
It hasn't. Yeah, exactly. And just one unfavorable statistics which adds to it is that an average EU citizen eats 66.4 kilo meat per year.
Oh my God, I weigh much less than that.
and which is again differing from country to country, and West European countries like Netherlands or Germany eat even above this average. And which is funny because this product delivers 25% of our average calorie intake for per person, but it produces 80% of the greenhouse gas emission from agriculture. So in conclusion, I would say that the EU policies... Go vegan or go vegetarian. My conclusion would be that EU policies on agriculture has failed nearly on every aspect, especially when it is about climate change. And in fact, these wrong policies have helped to increase the CO2 emission. Question again would be why these wrong policies are in place, and it really should be investigated. Who are the groups behind it, and which political parties?
You love investigations, right? And some funny cases like that. But going forward, actually, European Union is now putting forward more than 400 billions for the coming 6 years. And once again, the environment and climate is the center. But I'm afraid that, there won't be any different results unless the implementation and policy mistakes of the previous events, like you say, wouldn't be properly investigated. So, and then we also learn and whatever necessary, correct our actions so we can
exactly
achieve new something new instead with these 400 billions.
Exactly. And now we start with a new... So you have started nowadays making very cool videos. So maybe if you can show one of the videos on why impact investment is important for our planet and people.
Sure, yeah, let's see that. So what is impact investing? The definition, which is provided by Global Impact Investing Network and recognized around the world, is the following. So it is investment which generate positive social and environmental return beside financial return. And of course, it must be done with intention and the impact must be measurable. Okay, but what is the market size? So around the world, currently more than $800 billion are already invested in this topic. And if we go a little bit deeper, right? So what kind of companies do investors, impact investors, invest? So it is so-called, of course, social enterprises. But important is that they are, first of all, financially self-sustainable. They do create and measure impact. They are innovative and disruptive. How on earth you are going to combine high returns and impact otherwise if you are not using modern technologies or if you are not using innovative business models, right? So you must be innovative and disruptive. And last but not least, those companies are scalable. So we are talking about companies which are possible to scale up maybe in terms of one city or country, several countries. But don't forget that we don't want to scale unreasonably. And it's very important if you are a social entrepreneur to think about how big you want to grow. And last but not least, how are impact investments related to sustainable development goals? For those who are new, so sustainable development goals were defined by United Nations in 2015, and more than 17 goals, they are behind 169 targets of the social, environmental, and economical goals for the whole society, which we want to reach by 2030. And the fun part is that actually nowadays, impact investors, impact investing funds, and entrepreneurs are applying SDGs as a framework. So basically, SDGs are the impact themes, which makes our life easier. So if you are into climate change or if you want to contribute towards accessible education goal number 4, then you put it on your pitch deck as a project, for example, so investor would find you.
Thank you. That was a cool video. So we should really speed up. So as our viewers remember that last time we brought, or I think a couple of weeks back, an investor of renewable energy and a renewable energy project owner
and
together.
We tried to marry them.
Exactly. We tried to get them together. So today we bring a managing director of one of the most experienced and successful impact investment fund and an European project owner who is very active in Africa, bringing changes to the lives of millions and also making good return on investment. And as we have spoken also earlier, there seems to be a communication issue. For example, in our sector of impact investment, if you see, the governments are saying that they cannot realize the SDGs without the support of the private capital, and the private capital is saying that they need the support of the government. Same is happening with the projects. On one side, you have investors who are having difficulty in finding really good projects, and on the other side, you have project owners who can't find the investors.
That's completely true. So today, we are going to have an experienced impact investor and the project, as we already said. And with this, I'd like to welcome our guests. So please, Els Berhoff and Johan Frösling, welcome to the show.
Welcome.
Hello. Els. Hello. Welcome. Welcome. Hi. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
Great to see you. Great to see you. Before we start, I'd like just very briefly tell about you, Els, and about you, Johan, for our audience. What's your experience and how you ended up here with us today? So, Els Berhoff is an investment professional with more than 20 years of international experience in development finance and emerging markets in investments. So she is a partner and co-owner of Goodwell, and she has led the firm's launch in Africa and has been managing partner for West Africa for the Ubuntu Equity Funds. And of course, she is on the board of many, many companies and funds. So I'm not going
and
to list them all.
And especially Goodwill's microfinance equity fund in India,
exactly,
which always gets my attention.
Exactly. But it's amazing your experience. We are delighted to have you with us. And thank you for joining today. Thank you very much.
Yes. And I know also that she was in the past in FMO, which is a a name in the world of impact investment. It's a very powerful and brand name.
Yes. And Johan, he is from Sweden. It's great. We are going to Sweden today as well. So Johan,
and Sweden just won the football against.
So, if I just can continue. So Johan lives in the city Gothenburg with his lovely wife and children and even grandchildren. You look so young, Johan. I wouldn't say that. You have an impressive experience in petrochemical industry from Borealis Group, and you founded Confidere in 2005. You have also a lot of experience as a consultant and dedicate your current project to Africa. So you are traveling in between London, Johannesburg and Sweden around. And of course, now you are trying to get your project into life and make it fly. The Dynamis Investment Partners. But you will tell us a bit more yourself.
Exactly. So, Els, can you please tell us a little bit more about yourself, which we missed, and your organization, Goodwill?
I think you captured pretty much the highlights of me personally. Goodwill, my organization, is far more interesting. We've been around since 2006. We are an impact investment firm focused on inclusive growth. So we really focus on businesses that serve people in the base of the pyramid in Africa and India with basic goods and services. That's what we do. I am a development economist by education. And yes, I've been active in emerging markets for over 25 years already. Time flies. It's all I've ever done.
Thanks, Els. Thanks so much. And Johan, could you also please introduce yourself and briefly say what I didn't say before?
Yeah. And your project.
Thank you so much for the very good introduction. That you said most of it. I am a chemical engineer. I have been in the big corporate world in Borealis Group, and also as a consultant the last 1.5 decades. And in both those environments, we have been running major infrastructure projects like bioenergy, mining, nuclear, etc. And in Africa, we see that there is a need for infrastructure. Otherwise, we will never have a good sustainable growth there. And that's exactly what Dynamis does. Dynamis, we support sustainable growth in Africa.
Sounds great. So, but can you please explain us your project shortly and explain where do you stand now and what is your motivation of doing this at all?
Yes, of course. I mean, today there is like 1.4 billion people in Africa. In the next three decades, will probably be 100% more, doubled. It's quite obvious that if they are not doing this in a sustainable way, it will be a disaster for the people in Africa, but also for the people in other parts of the world. And I also have a specific heart for Africa, since we have family both in southern and central Africa. So that is it's really a part of my heart. And let's say for a person in Africa, of course, they have a lot of different backgrounds. Africa is a huge continent with different backgrounds of the people. But if they don't get a job, they cannot get their and impact their own future. To get the job, you need to have the foundation for a job. And then you need to have water, power, transportation in a sustainable way. Otherwise, they will not get jobs. So we are supporting that. The problem is that in many cases in Africa, the projects, the vital infrastructure projects, cannot be funded because they don't have the sufficient knowledge or particularly capital to develop this. So Dynamis, we go in with our capital, our know-how, we execute and drag in the capital needed from the big investment banks, from the energy funds, from different companies, etc., to make them viable.
Thank you.
Sounds great. But you also provide, so you do due diligence, right, on the project?
Yes, of course. Yeah. So we have a very strict checklist, a lot of requirements that needs to be in place. And of course, most important is that they can do good impact according to the SDGs that we have selected, number 6, 7, 8, and 9, which is water, transportation, power, and a good working environment. So,
Okay. All right. Then I move over to Els. So Els, you have gone through the whole evolution, like you said yourself, of impact investment in the last 25 years, and you have quite a track record. So what was your motivation to go into this? And I would be more interested to learn about what are the some of the good and bad experiences you had with your projects.
Yeah, I'll get to that. I remember very well what motivated to move into that. I was in university and I took a class in development economics.
Which university?
In the Netherlands, Tilburg University in the south. Yeah. And I was already convinced that poverty is just not right. It's not acceptable. You know, I was in puberty in the 80s. There was life aid. There was hunger in Africa. Poverty is not acceptable to me. And I took the class in development economics. And I thought, like, listen, if these are the problems in the world, we can send people to the moon in a rocket. Why can't we solve it? So it was really, I think, also the intellectual challenge that triggered me. And doing business in different cultures, working on interesting, mind-blowing problems. So that really triggered me to graduate and start working in this sector. I started to work in the banking sector because FMO, where I worked later, I immediately applied there from university and they said, sorry, we don't hire young graduates. Get 5 years of banking experience and then come back to us. I never saw myself as a banker, but it was great advice because I got a great education. 6 years later, FMO hired me. And there I really saw for the first time fantastic projects happening, especially in microfinance, which was my passion, still is a passion. And I can give you an example, Ben. One of the first project that I was involved in, it's famous around the world now, is Akleda Bank in Cambodia. But at FMO, we started it from the beginning. It was an NGO. And I remember staring at a balance sheet of $10 million. And I was like, how the hell am I going to sell this to the investment committee to put in more money? And some people found it disgusting. Nowadays, it was a big fight. I'll never forget that fight in the investment committee, but the chair of the committee supported our proposal. Nowadays, Akleda Bank is the largest bank in Cambodia. So from an NGO project with a credit component, it became the largest bank of Cambodia, serving millions of people, standing out as an example, you know, to the world of good governance and that it can be done. And of course, that was a great motivation for me. That also triggered all the beautiful projects that I saw at FMO. I went to the board in 2005 and I said, we're doing this with taxpayers' money. There are people out there with money, private investors, institutional investors, who want to participate in this as well. So we have to go to the market with these projects. That idea was too far ahead of time, I think. So the board said, no, you have a big job to do. Focus on that. That's it. And then the seed was planted for me to one day start my own impact investment firm. That's what we're doing now. We've raised over 200 million euros over the past years from private investors. 75% of the capital is private investors, 25% institutional. So we are bringing great impact investment opportunities to the market and showing very good IRRs in hard currency. So it is possible, and it is a dream come true.
That's incredible, Els. It's really amazing, the story, especially with the bank. Wow, congratulations. So it's your huge impact which you spread over years. That's really amazing. There was a little echo, isn't
it? Yeah, there is an echo. Somebody...
Els, could you make sure that your phone is not closed or not also linked to the StreamYard?
No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
And Els, you moved from India to Africa.
Yes. When we started with Goodwill, we simply looked at the map of the world. Where do most poor people live, right? And yeah. India, obviously, was an important market, if you can call it like that. But our investors of the first hour also wanted us to go to Africa, clearly. So from the outset, it was India where we would start first, and then we would move to Africa. That's what we did. But India has been an enormous success. When we started investing there, it was off the beaten track. There were not many people out there. So timing for us was good. We could invest in a lot of wonderful projects. And when the majority of investors came, we had enough exit opportunities. Right now, it's so busy in that market with so many people doing a good job that we felt like our role is to be first movers. Let's focus for 100% on Africa and demonstrate again, you know, what can be done. And slowly it starts to become busier in Africa as well. So that's great. And if I have to be honest, it would be great if we would be jobless, say 10, 15 years from now.
And can you say some of your bad experiences from impact investment or what you learned from it?
Yeah, of course. We have written off a few projects, not many, I must say. I think four on a total of 35. But operating in these markets is risky, right? Regulators take unexpected steps, events happen, elections are risky, etc. So it's very important that you spread your portfolio to be protected for these risks. We assume that black swan events are there all the time. It's a given. And the only way to protect for it is to be diversified. So yes, we have had a major crisis in India once or twice. We've seen funny events in Africa. We've never been cheated by any of the portfolio companies with fraud, I must say that. But some have suffered from market circumstances. So regulation and the political risk, I should say, it is there. And it hits you. So you better take measures how to deal with it, because it's there constantly. Secondly, I must say I've also been disappointed at times with co-investors, and not because everybody has different interests, because that's normal, but that as a group of investors, sometimes you just fail to find a solution which is in the interest of the business. You know, and then very often you would see that people would go for their own interest. And that is really, I find it very frustrating. So nowadays, when we look at projects, we also try to really look at who are the co-investors and who comes in as to manage that.
Exactly.
Yeah, this is what we teach also to our students, to properly select their investors, and that mission drift doesn't happen when the difficulties arises. So it's very important, of course. Johan, let me ask you also a similar question, because you're also not new in doing successful business in emerging markets. So what were your positive and negative experiences, especially in projects in Africa?
When we started Confidera, that was mainly in Europe. But then when we moved Confidera to Africa, because of the huge possibilities in Africa, because of the huge potential and also for the big needs, we found a lot of good people, and they are well educated, but the capital was lacking. So we saw that there is a fundamental systematic error in the financing market in Africa, and that is what we are going to solve. With our capital and with our risk, and Els was describing very well about spreading the risks, of course you need to do that, otherwise you cannot be sustainable. If you go all the way in with everything in one country and then they have a bad election or they have some turmoil there, you may lose all your money, and that's not sustainable. So we need to spread our risks. So being both holistic, have a helicopter view at the same time that you are doing the local business with the local people. That is the secret, I think. And being focused and curious and have a drive.
Mm-hmm. And how Dynamis is different from Confidere? Can you explain for our viewers, for those who don't know exactly the connection between these two?
Yes, of course. Confidere, we can do the whole project life cycle from the cradle to through execution and commission and closure, and make sure that everything goes live and it is well functioning on a consultancy basis. So it's a long term, but it's a low risk. In Dynamis, we do the opposite. We focus only on the feasibility study, making the project viable, bankable, get our return, and put that return into new projects. So we have a very high velocity of the capital, which is our success mark. High velocity of the capital, at the same time having a low risk. And of course, doing the impact. Otherwise, it will be totally in vain.
Great. As we are talking about performance here, Els, could you share with us how the performance of your fund has been? And last time we spoke, I think you mentioned also that you're starting a new fund. What will the new fund do?
Yeah, let me start with repeating what Johan said, because I think that's at the basis of the good returns that we are showing. We invest in local solutions for local problems. So really with African entrepreneurs, because they know best what the right solutions are for Africa. And far too often you see firms fly in, fly out investors thinking they know it all. That's not how it works. So we do that too. You would see for our funds on average net IRRs, so after deduction of management fees and everything, in euros of 15 to 20% annual. Mm-hmm. That's a very decent return, I would say.
Perfect.
And we've shown that both in India and also in Africa. So exits are possible. We've done deals from startup till IPO. That's a bit of an exception. You know, there are not that many IPOs in Africa, but in India, we've done two or three IPOs now. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's really, the results are good. And if you are a long-term investor, you can make very good returns. We are launching our fifth fund right now. And yeah, the fundraising is also, you see more and more people are looking at this. Our track record is starting to count. So we will be raising a fund of 150 to 200 million euros right now. And only last month, I think within 2 weeks, we raised the first 10 million euros already from private investors. Mm-hmm. The institutional campaign is yet to start. So the traction is there. Also ample investment opportunities. We normally invest the money within 3 years after raising it.
All right. Okay. And how many projects do you have in a fund like that?
Our average investment size is, I think, 3-4 million euros. Some are a bit larger, some are a bit smaller. What we do, again, to control the risk, is we start relatively small, sometimes with 500,000 only. It's private equity in local mm-hmm. businesses. We invest milestone-based. So if they develop according to plan, we put in more. And right now we have, I think, two or three companies where we are in with 7 or 8 million euros. But also with these, we started, you know, with 500,000 or 1 million. And mm-hmm. then over time, as they grow, you invest more. And again, a great way to control your risk. If they don't perform, you know, you haven't put in too much money. So that's another foundation underneath the results that we show.
Okay. But since you are facing always new investors and inviting them to come to your fund, is impact investment still as hard sell as you mentioned when you started your career, that you could not sell it?
It starts to become easier. Let me also emphasize that almost all our investors, I think 97%, participates in new fund if we launch it. So nobody is in fact leaving. So that's great. And your existing investors start to invest more. And yes, then you need to find new names. And slowly, not as fast as I would like, but if you're talking about institutional money, it's a conservative world. Regulation is, in my opinion, not encouraging, at least not in the Netherlands, institutional investors. So it is still slow, but with a track record like us, it becomes easier. At the same time, what hinders us, deal sizes in our segment, maybe not in Johan's sector in infrastructure, but deal sizes are relatively small. Institutional investors have big sums of money to invest, and they are looking for very big deals. And there aren't that many on the continent yet. If they would be prepared to invest a little amount now or smaller than they are used to, they manage the risk, they can become more comfortable with what's happening there, and then top up over time, which isn't too expensive to do repeat deals. But one way or the other, they prefer to invest in funds with a minimum size of 500 million euros because they want to invest minimum 50 million euros in the fund, have no more than 10%. And there's still a mismatch between the ideal world of the institutional investors and what's happening on the ground.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. We also hear, like, in our everyday working lives, that investors are looking for projects and projects are looking for investors. This is why we created the platform Chamomile, you know, to connect them. So, Johan, in your experience, how is it happening, like, with Confidere, with Dynamis now? How is it happening? Do you feel like it's difficult to find investors, or they are there around the corner? So how is it happening for you?
Yeah, if you had asked me 16 months ago, then I would say that we were well going to succeed. Then COVID came, and then a lot of the investors disappeared, of course. But there are mainly three different obstacles for us entrepreneurs, and where some investors have wrong perceptions or wrong ideas of what they should do. One thing is that a lot of them are searching for quick wins. If I just find the right tech company, I will be a billionaire. Very good. I want to have only that. Or they are looking at too narrow geographically, or to a too narrow technology sector, and that doesn't work either. Or they have just been fed with bad news and bad media about Africa, only hearing bad news. And if they have not been to Africa and seen all the progress and all the enthusiasm that is there, then I think that they would be much happier to invest in Africa, because Africa is the future.
Right. But how much are you looking for Dynamis? What do you need to get going?
The limit is £3 million. And it doesn't seem to be too much. And I recognize the problem that Els is describing. In some funds, they say that no, the minimum ticket size is 20 million. so that can be a problem, of course. But I'm very confident that we will find these 3 million in a really short time frame.
Mm-hmm. Else, I would like to know something of your personal opinion. So you come from Netherlands, just like me, and which is one of the most advanced nation in the sector of impact investment. And we have very progressive government regulations. Then please explain, why is the Dutch pension fund still one of the largest investor in companies like JBS, which is destroying the rainforest in Amazon? Rainforest in Indonesia.
Yeah, that's hard to answer for me, Ben, because I also don't go to the meetings where they make these decisions. I'm a bit critical of the environment and the regulator here in the Netherlands. I think they're not so encouraging. We are leading because we had a few enlightened people in the 70s who founded Triodos Bank or ASN Bank, which are green banks that have been around for a long time. A lot of ex-hippies started banking there. And nowadays, any regular person knows about this and can open an account there. So that's great. We have first movers. The Dutch are pragmatic in general. So that is all encouraging. But I think the regulator is too conservative. If pension funds want to move into alternative assets in Africa, the regulator expects the people in the board of the pension fund to be able to explain why they made this investment and what the details are. So, and then you are impacting upon people's, personal reputation. So in combination with, looking for big deals, I think also the regulator is not encouraging this kind of risk-taking and experimentation. And also the EU, you see it, they're very good in launching new regulations about reporting. You can report, but it starts with, creating a fertile ground for people to do things they are not used to, because it's unknown. And so it is innovation for pension funds. And big institutions and innovation is a difficult combination. So the incentive should be there. I believe the willingness is there, but these are oil tankers that take time. But I'm positive, otherwise I would no longer be in this business. And we receive calls, we talk to institutionals. But the risk is that investors in Europe miss the boat, because also on the continent in Africa, you see big institutional players nowadays that invest, African banks, African pension funds. In Kenya, for example, the pension funds are allowed to invest in private equity. I believe in Nigeria it's allowed now. Those markets are developing rapidly. So you have to be there in time to get the best returns.
Els, I completely agree with you. We are over talking, over regulating, over reporting, but not over acting. Mm-hmm. So it's really like everyone is talking, or like this, they're still talking about trade-off between impact and returns, which is not there. I hope now after COVID, it's clearly for everyone that there is no trade-off. You can have both impact and returns in this sector. But let me ask you also a bit in more detail, in what types of companies exactly you invest in, you know, at which stage they should be already, and what are the criteria and characteristics you look at when you decide invest or not?
Yeah, we invest in a number of sectors. I mentioned already financial inclusion, traditionally our bread and butter business, but nowadays it's about 35% of our business. Agriculture portfolio is growing rapidly because the world food problem that we need to tackle by 2050, feeding 10 billion people is huge, and we have limited area of land to grow more food, and the oceans are already depleted. At the same time, there's a lot of food loss, post-harvest losses in Africa, which are quick wins if we invest in mobility, logistics, infrastructure, as Johan is saying. So in Goodwill, we also invest in mobility and logistics, and other sectors of interest are health, energy, and education. We invest in Series A and B typically, sometimes pre-Series A, so relatively early stage. We have also invested in Series C rounds, but that was for companies that we have been investing in since the Series A or the pre-Series A. So relatively early. Yeah, and then when the bigger investors, the later stage, come in with the Series C, that's always a good moment for us to hand over the baton to others.
So you take the risk. This is great to see.
Yeah, we people see it as a higher risk, but I mentioned already you have to take informed risks. If you spread your risks, we are very comfortable with it. We see it as opportunities, and we're sometimes laughing that nobody else seems to see those opportunities. I mentioned already, if you invest milestone based and you put more money in the bigger ones that are doing well and growing well, then it's not as risky as people tend to believe. So yeah, we feel like a fish in the water in those markets.
And what were the reasons that you needed to say no to a project? Like, what is a deal breaker for you?
Normally team in the end. You know, we take a long engagement period. I mean, we only invest in teams that are really mission driven and want to change the world and the situation in the country. But in the end, you should be able to work together with the team, be able to handle crisis situations, because it's going to be a rocky road anyway, you know. And if they think we're going from A to B, it will never be in a straight line. And very often they don't end up at B, but they end in situation C or D. And you should be able to work together on that journey. So you need to be transparent. There must be trust, etc. And we take long engagement periods to test that out before we jump, so to say. And we want the portfolio companies also to be comfortable with us. They should also know who they marry. But if that's okay, so that the team in the end is the biggest thing, because the market is there.
Absolutely. But like, how do you expect the work going forward? So once you invest, like, how often do you communicate with the project, or like, how does it happen in the process?
Yeah, we have teams on the ground, and in the beginning, they work with the portfolio companies on a daily basis, right? And then you start to get used to each other, and it becomes weekly basis, then maybe monthly basis. And we had one investment in India. We had already diluted. We were investing in the startup stage. We had 35%. And after a number of years, we had diluted to 3%. Then they went for an IPO. We were no longer in the board, but they rang us up and they said, hey, this is a great moment coming up. We always appreciated how you worked with us. Would you like to join our IPO committee? And, you know, that for us is really what we appreciate. Then you've had also the kind of cooperation that you like to see. So normally it reduces over time because things start to go more fluently, and sometimes there's a crisis and then you need to step up, and sometimes people are demotivated because of it. They need a shoulder to cry on, you know, that all that happens, but it's life. So we are on a journey with those teams.
Right, but this very valuable insights, I think, for everyone who wanted to apply for Goodwill money. Johan, let me ask you now, tell us more about your company, Dynamis, of course, and the history. Why did you started it? And so please give us a pitch of Dynamis.
Yes. So first, the name Dynamis, it's Greek for potential, ability, power, to create something that is not visible now. So it's that is exactly what Dynamis is about. We create things, we make things happen, which otherwise would have been very hard to happen. As I said earlier, there is a systematic error in the financing market in Africa. So even if there are good projects, they cannot get the funding for the studies which are needed to get the big money from investment banks and energy funds and DFIs, etc. And what we do is that we go in with our capital, know-how and our contacts, and we innovatively and agile develop these projects so that they and massage them so that they are viable.
I like that massage.
Yes, because sometimes a project owner might have an idea. They say it should be 100 megawatts and say, well, why exactly 100 megawatts? And then they don't know. So we need to help them with that. Mm-hmm. And then we when we have attracted the funds from loan providers and equity partners, then we take our profit, which is typically four times the money that we have put into the project. And so the profit can be reinvested and reinvested and reinvested. And that is why the comparably low amount of £3 million can make a huge impact. So with that little amount, in the next 4 years, we will attract $1.8 billion in loans and equity. And providing power, electricity power for 9 million people in sub-Saharan Africa, raising their average GDP with $1,000 per capita. And that's a huge leap. And actually, we are not solving the problem once, because when they have come that far, we can help them to reach even further so that they can have the same life as we have in Europe. I think that is rather fair, right? Mm-hmm. Our team, we have one team in Sweden, we have one team in Johannesburg, and then we have also partners in Africa, for example, big engineering firms like Gibb Engineering, WSP, etc., and of course the different banks, etc. And also we work very well with the DFIs and export credit institutions from different countries so that we can make projects viable who otherwise wouldn't have been viable.
And what is the impact of your project, or how do you plan to measure the impact?
Yes, we have a logic model according to the theory of change. And as I said, with our projects, we will provide power 200 kilowatt hour per year per person for 9 million people. That will automatically more or less give more growth in that region, and with that growth they will have better health care, better food, less time to go to their job in the morning, etc., etc., etc. So we will actually change the lives for millions. And also, today, you know, you have people who are well educated, have a doctor degree or a master, and they are driving taxi or selling radio or something like that, which is totally waste of talents. With our help, they can get a good job and be a part of the society to really create their own future as well.
Okay. And else, how do you measure the continuous impact of your project? Because when you're investing in a project, are you also asking the project owner to do an impact measurement? And how do you keep on doing it?
Yeah, I mean, it starts with project selection. We only invest in businesses that have a mission, that are really impact driven. So that's where it starts. And we have built a framework for Goodwill where, you know, we have our own teams on the ground. We also have partners. We select impact driven partners. And there are things that we can do ourselves. There are things that our portfolio companies do. And there's impact for the end users. And in all levels, we measure what is happening. But what I like to highlight is that there is an impact measurement. There is quantitative and a qualitative aspect. So you can measure how many people have I reached, how has the income increased, has travel time reduced, has turnover gone up, have taxes been paid. But the how you do things is at least as important of what you do. And financial inclusion is a nice example. If you are a banking in like a vulture, your interest rates are too high, your repayment rates requirements are too harsh. If there is a crisis and people can't repay and you're not prepared to reschedule, or you're sending digital text messages to people like, hey, it's about the weekend is about to arrive. Do you want to borrow 20 euros so that you can go gambling? In that way, you do more harm than good. So we have also been founding our co-founders of industry initiatives to develop codes of conduct for how we do things in the industry so that our portfolio companies can lead by example. And normally we don't have to arm twist our portfolio companies to embrace these codes of conduct. Normally, you know, they do it voluntarily. And if they hear about it and they haven't been invited for it by us yet, they ring us up and say, hey, what's this? I want to participate. That really happens. So there's two sides of it. There's the quantitative side, but we should not forget the qualitative side of things.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And since both of you are experts on Africa, and I mean, I have also been talking about this since many years, that it has some of the places in Africa has the highest GDP growth, and the market in many sectors are virgin, or there's a huge space to grow. But yes, there are also instabilities of politics, economics, environment. So how do you mitigate these risks for the investors? By spreading the risk, or how?
It's a question to both, right?
Shall I answer it? Yeah. So one thing is to spread between different countries, because you never know exactly what will happen in the politics, for example. And the other thing is to spread your risks between different sectors, so not only one technology. And the third one is to be very thorough when you follow the project, when you do the development of the project, so that you find these early signs that no, this will not work out well, so that you can mitigate before it becomes a problem. And sometimes you just cut the funding and work on other projects instead, to be able to work on the things that has a future.
Yeah, only one thing to add there, because I fully concur with what Johan is saying. What we also see that social impact, or impact, I should say, and risk management are two of the same. Because if you're doing the right thing, you're doing what's really needed, your risks are a lot lower. That's what we see. Because if you invest in goods and services that are always needed, even if you have a black swan event like COVID-19, like what we had, because we invest in basic goods and services, you know, these flourished during COVID-19. And also regulators sometimes do things that you may not want to see, but when they realize that you're doing the right thing for the country and for their people and for their voters, they may probably leave it alone. So doing the right thing is a big risk mitigator.
Mm-hmm. How do you define the right thing? This is, I think, always what is the right thing?
Yeah, well, I mentioned already access to basic goods and services. Mm-hmm. If you look at a relatively poor household in India or in Nigeria, and you look at their wallet, what are they spending their money on? 50% of that income goes into food. I believe 20 or 25% goes into transportation. Then I'm not talking about the time in traffic yet. Housing, healthcare, etc. And people do need to eat every day. They do need financial services every day. Even during Corona, people had to go to work, and take transportation. So it, basic goods and services, or what Johan mentioned, infrastructure, the countries need it. Those are good sectors to invest in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another thing is to balance between private and public project owners and public and private money and customers, because all the countries, 54 of them in Africa, are different. So in some cases, the government is strong and has a good balance sheet, but the private sector is poor. Then you act differently than if you have a poor government and a big and flourishing private sector, and find the mix there. That's another thing to de-risk.
I just wanted to add something to Else's comment. Else, one of my family members many, many years ago wrote an article on economy of the poor, and he won the Nobel Prize on it.
Is he a relative of yours?
Yeah. Have you read his article?
Of course.
Okay. Because when you said what you said, yeah, I could already find the points from there, because he did his study 30 years long.
It's Abhijit, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Abhijit Banerjee.
No. Abhijit got last year. And yeah. Amartya Sen.
Okay.
Wrote the article on economy of the poor.
Yeah. I have the book in my cupboard here.
Yeah. By the way, both of them are in my family.
Okay.
We are proud of you.
I have three Nobel Prize winners in my family.
Oh, wow.
Also Rabindranath Tagore.
Okay. Wow. So are you going to be next, Ben?
No.
Global impact.
I'm the black sheep.
Yeah, but it makes sense. These books are very interesting because they've really studied, does it work, and where do poor people spend their money? Portfolios of the Poor, Stuart Rutherford, what do people really spend their money on? How do they manage their finances?
Again, a feedback.
Those are very interesting books to read. Mm-hmm. So if there are students looking at this broadcast as well, there are very interesting books that have been written on this topic, really about the life in the base of the pyramid and what happens on a daily basis.
Exactly. And they created the economic model based on it.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, they got the Nobel Prize, but nobody implemented it.
Yeah. Well, it's a mass market and a huge market.
Exactly. So can we, with your permission for the viewers, do a short kind of pitch where maybe the viewers can learn from it? If Johan tells Else what his business is about, by now Johan has already told Else a lot. And Else, can you reply on how you look at it as an investor to his business? And you can ask directly questions on that.
Yeah. How I look at Johan's business, I think it's very catalytic. As he indicated, being at the beginning of a project chain, you're really unleashing something. So when you look at bang for a buck, you invest basically your efforts in something at the beginning of exponential growth, I think. So the leverage of what you're doing is very high. And if you want maximum impact, I would always recommend people to be early stage, because that's when it is the hardest, and that's where the real projects are born, and we need more of them. A question to Johan would be: what has been your biggest challenge in growing your business and doing what you do? Where did you really have to push yourself hard to get it done?
I think the biggest challenges are perceptions, mainly from European people and investors about Africa. You know, still when we talk about Rwanda, and Rwanda is one of the countries, as you know, on the African continent with the highest growth rate and very good stability, a very low crime rate, etc. People say, well, don't they have a war there? Yes, that was 27 years ago. Mm-hmm. A lot has happened since then. And, you know, with bad perceptions and bad misunderstandings, it's much harder to do a good work. Mm-hmm. So that's my biggest challenge, I think.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions to Johan else before you would invest?
Johan, where do you hope to be 10 years from now with your business?
Yeah, we have, of course, a growth plan. And let's say 2 or 3 years down the road, we will have a choice how we will grow in a more to be even bigger and make even bigger impact. Either do more projects, or that we do bigger projects, or that we take a stake in the projects. It's very important that all the shareholders that they agree with that change, because it will mean different risks. Mm. I think that after we have done huge impact in Africa, I think that there is similar need in Latin America and in parts of Asia as well. It's just that we don't have the knowledge there yet.
Okay, and which countries are high on your wish list in Africa?
Oh, there's a whole bunch of them. Let's say a dozen of them. Let's say, yes. Mozambique, Rwanda, Congo, Zimbabwe, Nigeria, Cote d'Ivoire, Ghana. There are a lot and more of them.
Good. Well, you won't be bored, I think, in the next 10 years.
That sounds good. But Johan, what else should we know about your project? What wasn't said yet? Because, I mean, there are a lot of important points. What is the SWOT, you know, analysis of your project? The strengths, the weakness, and so on.
I'm more interested in the threat. So what would the investor see as a threat or a risk for investing in the project?
Well, I think that they think that it's a high risk. But since we have very good methods and measures to de-risk and spread the risk and reduce the risk, it's actually a lower risk than a lot of other so-called low-risk investments. Then, of course, there is a lot of things to information to share with else, but that is our own IP, which I cannot broadcast over the whole world.
Yeah, exactly. And I understand completely.
Now we are slowly going to NDA, no? No, but it was very interesting to see also how very cautious both of you, you know.
Yeah.
The marriage is not happening right away with projects and investors. This we understood already.
Exactly.
Right?
But from the viewer's point
never
of view.
Never on the first date, or what you say.
That's also boring. You need to take time. You know, you shouldn't be reckless. It's a long-term business. I think that's the same for Johan. Long-term business, and you better invest time in the beginning than, you know, spending a lot of being disappointed later on. So and the engagement period is nice. You can date with many projects, and you only have funding for a few. So yeah, in that way, you can make good choices.
Exactly. And else, if from the viewer's point of view, when somebody tells you about the project, so what are the first, as an investor, what are the first things you click in your mind? Is the risk, the viability, the feasibility?
Impact. Immediately look at impact, and are these people really impact driven? We are approached a lot by Western entrepreneurs with solutions for Africa or India. I think that's probably 40% of what lands on our desk. Is it a local solution for a local problem? Are the entrepreneurs really mission driven? That's where it starts. And normally you see it already in the material that they send to you. Of course, it's also important, how do they present themselves? Have they paid attention? It doesn't have to be perfect, but you can see it straight away whether somebody is paying attention to what he or she is doing. And if you see that, yes, it has been taken care of, they have also seriously studied goodwill. I mean, a lot of projects come via existing portfolio companies of ours or via our local team members, but we get interesting applications online as well. And you can simply, very quickly see the level of attention that has gone in. And that's very important for a first screening. And then when we go into the engagement period, it's really about openness and transparency. You try to test that, of course, what people told you before. When you ask the same question later on in a different way, is the answer still the same or more or less the same? Or are people hiding things? Are they prepared to talk about the big challenges? You know, a great example is when you look at a microfinance organization, I always ask the question, when was your last fraud case? Because fraud happens everywhere in banking. It can't be prevented. And if they say, oh no, we are well secured, we don't have fraud here, then I'm tempted to run out of the meeting immediately. Because, but there are also people who say, oh no, really? Do you really want to know? We're so ashamed. This and this happened. And this is what we did. And this is what we're still struggling with. Those are the people we want to work with. Because it's going to be a rocky road. And if you don't want to face it, and you don't want to work together with others to solve your problems, that's also a lesson I've learned in life. You know, if you have a problem, talk about it, because 9 out of 10 cases, somebody else already has a very easy solution for you. So we're looking for teams that want to work together.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. No, this is very, very good learning for the viewers.
Johan, yes. And what is it for you? You know, like when you were selecting your investors, like on what you are paying attention usually, because it should be from both sides, you know, when you as a project, as a company, what are your values in this regard?
Yeah, also there, we would like to have the heart for the business, the heart for the impact, of course, not only hard figures, even if hard figures can combine very well with good impact, definitely. Then we have a long checklist. And it's a similar checklist that we have when we are searching money for our projects. We are having a similar checklist for potential investors in Dynamis with a lot of checkpoints. And we go through, you know, there are different lists of barred organizations or users, and we also have our own network check that we check with embassies, we check with Chamber of Commerce, we check with and of course hopefully a physical meeting. That is a little bit trickier now with COVID, but when you meet people in person, it's easier to feel what they really think and what they really have in mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And how your experience has been in terms of like you already selected some projects in Africa, right? So you have a pipeline. How did you do that? Online?
Yeah, we had a pipeline.
Or you were there physically in Africa to select the project which you want to support?
We have a pipeline of about a dozen of project candidates. They are not selected yet, but they are candidates of different degrees, let's say so. We go in the old world when there were a lot of fairs and exhibitions and so, then it was easier. We also go on business delegation trips together with other exporting companies. We have a network with partners in Africa. We also get IDs from different embassies, etc., etc. And also with some of the vendors, then when they have a potential customer, they can route that customer to Dynamis, and then we get a good project ID in our lap, so to speak. And but of course, always check, because not all the projects are good projects, but we can make more of them happy.
But are you one like else mentioned, an European who is sitting in Europe and has a brilliant idea for Africa, or you are also having people on the ground in Africa, having people there, working with local people there?
Yeah, of course we have people. We have a team in Johannesburg, and then of course some people say that Johannesburg is not real Africa. I don't care about those people. but we have also people in Mozambique. We have people in Rwanda and other different partners in different countries. I personally have not visited more than 11 countries, I think. But I have partners who have been in 35 countries. So that's a little bit more.
That's impressive.
You should know. You should ask Els the same question. She has lived. She lives nearly in Africa half of her time.
Yeah, I've also worked in Joburg in the past for a while. And Johan, I agree with you. South Africa is definitely also Africa, and it's one of the countries in the world with the highest level of inequality. So, you know, we're badly needed there. And also in your sector, infrastructure, there's a lot of things to be done there. Just coming back, Ben and Sveta, to your question about what do you look for? One thing I'd also like to mention is a good business plan, of course, right? Yes, it starts with impact and what are you doing, but there must be a good business plan, well thought through, realistic. You know, at least have some scenarios and something we can talk about. So the business plan has to be good. And we also prefer entrepreneurs that have gone through some sort of crisis already, because we want to see people with staying power. And you learn most from your mistakes. So it's a safer investment if people have you know, being very close to the situation already where they had to turn off the lights, for example, or turbulent markets. So, people who have been in the trenches have a preference for us.
It's like in relationships also, no? When you go together through some turbulences.
Yeah, exactly.
Johan, I also wanted to ask you, because we've heard how Els could get into impact investing quite very early. It's the life stage. How did you know about impact investing, and how did you get into this sector at all?
I would say that we had the strive and the ideas before we know that there was something called impact investment.
And when was that?
Short answer.
Very short answer. We need more details.
Now, I would say that it's the same. If you have Googled impact investment 5 years ago, you would have got maybe two hits or something, and then it has been just going up like that. So it's something really important and hot. Of course it's a problem when things goes so hot that it becomes a buzzword. So in some cases, people just have the okay. Let's put that sticker on our business, and actually they have not changed, or they have not really put their minds or their heart into it. They just rebrand it, and that's not good.
Johan, I guess you saw the need in those markets and also the huge opportunity, right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. I know, for example, when we were in Congo, some people in Europe, they think that, okay, if the Africans only get a wire with the power, if they only have a connection, they will be happy. But in a lot of cases, you have a connection, you have a water pipe, but it doesn't come any water when you like, or you put the power on the stove and it's lukewarm because the voltage is too low. So you can't use it. So then people will use charcoal on their backyard anyway and get fumes. So it's totally useless. So having real power that is really working 24 hours per day, that is really impacting me.
Yeah.
And do you think it's a question to both of you? You know, because we need to provide in leapfrog solutions, right? Not the things which we are using here in Europe or US, you know, because otherwise we will create even more climate change problems and so on. So, Johan, is your project enabling also this leapfrog for Africa? And else, how do you see that? Like, do you only select the projects which are enabling this leapfrog, or also still old kind of solutions?
By leapfrog, you mean climate positive technologies, innovation.
Yeah, exactly.
Social.
You jump over some of the steps that we have had in Europe.
Absolutely.
In some of the cases, we are doing the same things, new leapfrogging. In other cases, for example, we have a city development project in a place, and there we have the chance to do things right from the beginning. So we can have electric buses directly instead of going all the traditional way, which is not sustainable.
Yeah, on our side, I think, especially in financial services, we have been leapfrogging massively. We invested in mobile payments in 2010, not because it was called fintech. Maybe that word hardly existed, but because it was needed. And Africa had no bank branches. And in a country, in places without infrastructure, without electricity, without roads, you know, you can't build a bank the traditional way with 600 branches spread out over a country. So mobile payments with a network of agents spread out over Nigeria was a logical thing to do. And that's why we did it. And nowadays, also in the Netherlands last week, there was again another big deal in the fintech space in mobile payments. Yeah. It's very recent that these deals are hot here in Europe. And 10 years ago, when we made our first investments there, nobody really understood it. But okay, that's fine. So this was really leapfrogging. But in agriculture, for example, I mentioned it already, we are very interested in reducing post-harvest losses and improving mobility and logistics locally. That is not sexy, but it is just focusing on the low-hanging fruit, food that is produced already but which never reaches the market. So we're not in high-tech agriculture doing new things, but in agri, it's pretty basic. Invest in processing capacity locally, invest in better functioning value chains, etc. So across the sectors, what we do is different.
Yeah. Else, can I ask you? Once we had previously a speaker. She's the president of Mauritius, but also a bio scientist, biodiversity scientist, and she's now leading AGRA, that is the Alliance of Green Revolution in Africa, from Kofi Annan. And she mentioned that one of the things in Africa is that Africa has immense different kind of agriculture, foods, plants, and all local and native, and which are really good, not only for the people, but for the nature. But because of this quick agriculture, these are being destroyed, and there's a coming a sort of monoculture, which is being imported or forced or enforced upon them, because that is what Europe or the other continents need. So when you do your investment, do you pay attention also to this, that the local agriculture is kept, or you also invest only in cash crops or monoculture?
No, we don't invest a lot in primary agriculture, as I mentioned, you know, because there's a lot produced already. But we have one exception in our portfolio, Good Nature Agro in Zambia, doing exactly this, you know, having the right variety of seeds. And it can even differ from region to region, what is the best soy seed or what is the best product to grow there. And you need to rotate crops for soil protection, and there's biodiversity. Exactly. So this Good Nature Agro in Zambia is an example. And we felt we just have to do it, because, you know, this is a simple way of increasing returns, fostering biodiversity. It's far more sustainable. So that's why we have invested in a company like that.
Okay.
Last question, because actually we are running out of time. Both of you, you know, with Europe, with enormous need for raw materials and projects, and Africa, which needs infrastructure, money, expertise, and knowledge, it seems like it should be the perfect match or marriage in heaven, but it seems like it's still not happening. So what is hindering, is on the way to do that, to for this to happen?
Yeah, I would say it is happening also in Africa, but at a smaller scale. And because it's smaller, many people think it's not so beautiful. But a lot of it is about major changes. There is exponential growth. And right now, the levels may not be that high, but exponential growth is growing very rapidly. And like we've seen in India, I remember 2005, 6, 7, nobody was there. Now everybody is there. I would say it really pays off to go somewhere early, dip a toe in the water. You don't have to overstretch yourself in terms of risk taking, but be sure you are there and you become familiar with what's happening. Mm-hmm. It's because people also don't know what's happening. It's unfamiliar. So I would really encourage go now, because otherwise you are too late. Africa is the last, I would say, destination in the world that is yet to be fully discovered. And we see it in our own portfolio of investors. The best businessmen in our portfolio are already also co-investing with us directly in Africa. And these guys and girls aren't stupid. So I would say, don't miss the boat. Follow these wonderful entrepreneurs.
Sounds great. Johan, what would you say? And what would be your message for our audience also?
Yeah, I would say the same as else. It is already happening. But a lot of the things that is happening is not visible, or at least when you look at the newspaper. And it is happening, and it's happening fast, and we are helping them to do this in a good way, not only fast.
So but the message is go to Africa.
So go for Africa.
Thank you.
Thank you to both of you for joining us today. It was a really very interesting conversation. And yes, I hope you can discuss, if you want to, behind the curtains, any business opportunities together.
First football, I think.
Oh, yeah, today's
football. Nice to meet you, Johan. Yeah. Thank you.
Nice, very nice meeting you, Els. Let's keep in touch.
Yeah, I hope so. We'll connect.
Bye, everyone.
Bye, everyone. Thank
Bye.
You.
Bye. Thank you.
Yes, that was a really interesting
journey
again. Again, of course, with us is always interesting, right?
Exactly.
And because of that, I want to remind our audience to subscribe to our YouTube channel to be updated when new videos are coming out. Who is coming next week?
Oh, so next week is again quite a similar kind of case, but this time it's a fund which is again being represented by somebody and coming. It's an old friend of ours, Christian Terbach Faust, who is running the Chi Impact Capital
from Switzerland,
from Zurich, the background picture, and Tim Breaker from the company Vital, where they have invested in. So in this case, the difference is that it is a fund and it is a company. So now we are going to see what they are doing with each other, the investor and
they
the investor.
They are already married. Whoa, yeah. That's interesting. All right. So, then I guess see you next Friday.
Exactly.
With Impact. Thanks for watching us.
Thanks for watching us. Bye.
Welcome to Swiss Impact with Banerjee. I'm Svetlana.
And I'm Ben.
In season 2, we will be traveling around the globe, out of Switzerland, and bring amazing leaders from businesses, thought leaders, political leaders, of course, investors and experts.
We're working at implementing and realizing all the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, better known as SDGs.
And they are also making profit.
Hello, I am Amina Gurifakim, and I'm the sixth president of the Republic of Mauritius.
My name is Parvati, and I'm a musical artist and the founder and CEO of Parvati Foundation.
I'm Amisha Adish Bhushan. I'm an entrepreneur here in Bhushan. I'm running on one side a financial services company.
You know, hundreds of deals a month, we are seeing more things happening in this impact world. And this is because, look, the world is changing.
So join us to discover impact investing ecosystem.
See you every Friday afternoon at 3 p.m. Central European time at Swiss Impact with Benedict.
See you on Friday. Act with impact.